It's got crazy insertion losses and group delays and filter functions. So you're doing amplitude pre-distorting as well as timing phase type pre-distorting to make it all come out right is my guess. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
That's 100% correct. Now, going back into the old method of television transmission, in terms of the effects of group delay and amplitude distortion, a lot of that shows up in the color of the picture, where that when you have group delay that's actually causing effects, and this is over a single frequency, really, at 358, but at various different phase angles. So you might actually, if you have what we would call differential phase, you would have the skin tone of, say, one part of the face is a particular color, and when you get to, because the television is scanning it, it's in time, when you get to the other side of the face, it might actually be a slightly different color because of the phase distortions that are going on. And in terms of differential amplitude, you might actually have the hands being a good flesh tone of a certain intensity of color, and you would have a dimmer flesh tone as you move towards a different section of the picture, and that's differential amplitude distortion. So it became rather complex. Now, all those factors really still exist in the digital domain, but they manifest themselves differently.
Built in, I think it was, we just heard a sign-in by a Echolink, something like K1ILK. We'll pick up with you in a second. The television receiver in the old days of analog television, before they became more integrated circuit-like, there used to be a delay line within the television receiver itself. And I think that delay line, I'm going to make a guess, is because the process circuitry that processed the color information, the chrominance information of 3.579545 megacycles, that filtering and logic function had an extra delay with reference to the luminance signal that didn't go through that, the amplitude signal, so to speak. So I am guessing there was a delay line delaying the amplitude signal compared to the color signal to make it all come out right. In some cases, maybe that delay line was a coiled up piece of coaxial cable with compensators. A bunch of guesses on my part. You've lived through that analog television receiver design phase of, let's say, the 60s and 70s, and you might want to give us a couple of words on that one, because it's another kind of a delay correcting factor. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, K2RIW, K2EJ. There's two different kinds of delay lines in the analog television receiver. One delays 64.5 or 64.3 microseconds. That's one, that's the big delay line. That's usually a piece of cardboard with a lot of wire wrapped around it. That gave you a one-line offset between the chrominance and the luminance, between the black and white part and the color part, so that they would sit on top of each other properly. In the older set, there was another delay line to give you a 90-degree phase shift from the color oscillator, so that way you would have a 0-degree and a 90-degree reference that went into a set of balanced modulators to actually take and separate the two different color subcarriers, one being in phase, or the I component, one being quadrature phase, or the Q component. Now, the reason for that is, from that, you can create a vector that would cover 360 degrees. That's how we actually transmitted the color information. With these two, this in-phase component, which was 0 degrees, actually 180 degrees from the subcarrier that was generated by the first reference signal that's transmitted on every line, and the quadrature component, which would go into a balanced modulator, and that would give you what color it was. And because this is really kind of you can think of it as a single sideband signal within the video portion of the signal, that would give you you would actually increase and decrease the amplitude of both of those components, which would then give you the intensity of color. So one was to match the actual color image.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I can see why color television analog signal receivers were kind of expensive in the beginning, elaborate to align, particularly with the tri-dot cathode ray tube type thing. Wow. As that became more and more integrated circuit, life became easier. When it comes to Moore's Law, this guy Moore, who's one of the founders of Intel, saying that every 18 months you're going to double the number of transistors you have on a computing chip, and I think they're now getting down to either 20 nanometers or 14 nanometer gate length in their integrated circuit chip transistors, and I think they're suddenly finding out that they're getting expensive as opposed to getting cheaper. I wonder if you saw that article, Eric. It's in some of the latest news journals that all of a sudden the foundries producing the chips are starting to run into some real problem. They're starting to run into what maybe temporarily is a stone wall, but they've been there for a while, and it's looking like it's an awful solid wall. They're not going to be able to break through this one so easily. I wonder if you've seen that, any info on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Actually, there's a lot of work going on in that. Up at MIT, they're starting to do what they're calling quantum computing. There's another lab at MIT that is doing photonic computing. So you can just guess from the two words that I used where they're going with that. And they're actually beginning to be successful at it.
Okay, so what Intel or those people are running into maybe is temporary. By the way, we've had a significant person die from ham radio in the last a day and a half or day or so. Was Steve Polishin, K1FO, used to be WA1FFO. Later on, he became K1 Far Out in Madison, Connecticut, a real big moon-bound sky. He's the producer of the Lunar Link transmitters, which were parallel kilowatt strip line amplifiers. He used the 8930, I think, tubes as opposed to 4CX250B tubes, which is what I used. But for a good number of years, he was manufacturing those transmitters. Lunar Link, I think, was the name of one of his companies. He had another company before that. And so he has no children. I've been at his QTH. He had a very nice moonbound setup in Connecticut. And he passed away of cancer about a day or so ago. That was announced at the Central States VHF Society meeting, and my good buddy was just coming home from that meeting this afternoon and talking to me on the telephone, and some interesting antennas appeared at their antenna gain competition, but that's another whole subject in itself. So I guess we ought to go back to group delay distortion. Before I go over to Wes, is there anything else that you think we should be adding on the confusion I've already created so far, Eric? It's not an easy subject. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Actually, now, group delay and group distortion is a very major part of digital television. And we can get into the equalizers. We've had this discussion in the past where that the equalizers are somewhat smart in being able to compensate for that. So you can have a somewhat waxed out transmitter and you see it's still going to function pretty well. But that's a whole other long discussion, and you should pick up the person who checked in on Echolink because I'm sure they had something to say. K4IW, K2J.
Very fine. I think it's K4ILK, repeat. Correct me on the call letters, and you told me last week, and I've already forgotten your name, sir. K4ILK, question mark, K2RIW.
You have Julia Poor, India Lima Kilo. Yeah, the name here is Ricky, Romeo India Charlie Kilo Yankee. I had a question. When I hook my television up to the component from the cable box, it gets audio but no video. But when I hook it up to the video one or the front video, it gets video and audio. Why is that?
Are you using an external digital television converter box, Richie? Is that what you're doing? You're marrying an external digital television type converter box with your analog television? Is that what you're doing? Over to you, Richie.
It's a cable box, and when we hooked it up, it had no picture at first, but then I switched some cables and it worked. So could it be the TV or the box?
Eric, if you're still there, I wonder if you've got a guess as to what could be going on. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
There could be several things happening. If he's coming from the cable box, you're going into the video connector. On the back of the cable box, you'll find that there's three connectors. One will be labeled Y, and one will be labeled PR, and another one will be labeled PB. Those are the component video outputs. And if you have an analog television that doesn't take component in, you'll have an input that says video 1, or video. And you'll find on the back of the cable box a connector, usually it's a phono connector, it'll have a little yellow input, and that will be labeled video. Your audio, of course, will have a red and a white phono connector. That's what you're going to connect to your audio input to the TV. So if you're using the component out and you're going into a TV set that doesn't understand that, you're not going to get anything. And typically when you have the component output, they tend to put out a different scan rate than the video out, which would be probably a high def out. Most cable boxes want to go to a modern day TV set, which will play what we call 720p or 1080i, and your conventional color TV from the analog world doesn't understand that at all. It'll never lock up to it. It'll never see anything. So what you want to do is you want to go from the video out, which will be the yellow phono connector, and go into the video in of the TV set. And in some cases, you actually have to make a setting in the cable box to produce the correct output. Does that help you at all?
You've got it, Richie.
Yeah, Roger. And the other quick question I had is, when I hook it up to an HDMI cable, it gets no video, no audio, and the TV says no signal. Why is that? Over.
You've got it, Eric.
All right. If you're going to an HDMI connector, it should pretty much be all automatic. If you're coming out of HDMI, out of the cable box, and going into the TV set, make sure your TV set has one HDMI connector. It might have several. You have to make sure that you've selected the right one in order to get anything out of it. And if you say you've connected into the connector that says HDMI 1, and the menu on your TV set says HDMI 1, and you get nothing, then you either have a problem with the cable box, you may have a bad HDMI cable, or you may have a bad TV set. If you have a DVD player which has HDMI out, start with that. Plug into the DVD player or your Blu-ray player, and if that works fine, then plug it into the cable box, and if you get nothing, then you have a bad cable box.
Over to you, Richie.
Yeah, Roger, okay. That answered my question. Now, the other question I had that comes to mind is, doesn't a moon beam have more power radiating out of it so it can bounce off the moon than a standard 2-meter Yagi does?
I think in general the answer is yes. With reference to the new digital techniques called weak signal Joe Taylor, WSJT, K1JT invented a whole series of digital techniques by which a guy with 100 watts output on 2 meters and a good long Yagi, one single Yagi, he can do moon bounce when he's talking to one of the big guns. but in the old-fashioned way of doing moon bounce, where you're not using a digital computer, where it's really a human being with a set of earphones listening to the signal, you got to have 1,000 watts out of the transmitter. You have to have roughly 400 square feet of antenna area on transmit and receive in order to get reliable reception, because the signal going that quarter of a million miles to the moon, and only 7% of the signal that hits the moon reflects and comes back to the Earth. And if you talk about the fact that the moon is only half a degree wide, and your transmitting antenna might be 10 degrees wide, you can see how the 90-some-odd percent of the signal you're sending toward the moon misses the moon entirely. And of the signal that hits the moon, let me drop.
What's the power loss in dBm?
That's what exactly what I was getting to. Of the 7% that hits the moon, of the signal, the small percentage of signal that hits the moon, only 7% reflects back. When you look at the whole round-trip path, boy, where you carefully adjust the power going into the transmitting antenna, and you look at the amount of signal coming back from the receiving antenna, and you know the gain of those two antennas, and you work out all the mathematics, the round-trip loss to the moon and back on 432 megacycles is something like 263 decibels. That's a lot of loss. In other words, if you compare the amount of signal you transmit versus the amount of signal you get back, you put one with 26 zeros after it. That's the ratio of power you send versus what you get back. 263 dB of loss on 432. A little less loss on 2 meters, a hell of a lot more loss on 1296. But that's the power spread you have to overcome. Once you know the 263 dB on 432, and you figure out how many dBm of power you're transmitting, a kilowatt is plus 60 dBm, you figure out transmit power, feed line loss, antenna gain on transmit, antenna gain on receive, feed line loss, preamplifier noise figure, and receiver bandwidth. You pour into that all of those mathematics, you on paper ahead of time can say, yes, your system stands a chance to be successful, or no, you're 10 dB shy, and you don't stand a chance. So knowing the numbers of path loss in dBs allows you to figure out what you've got to do in order to make it possible. And in general, it separates the men from the boys. I think only one ham in 10,000 probably is capable of doing moon bounce. Over to you, Richie, K2RIW in the
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
KJ, flyer. Okay, so you're saying that more than half the amount of power you're transmitting going up to the moon is lost coming back down to the receiving station.
No. I'm saying of the power you transmit, the kilowatt that you transmit, you're lucky if you get back a millionth of a billionth of a watt. So of the power that you transmit, most of it misses the moon. Of the portion, of the little bit of it that hits the moon, 7% reflects back. There's a tremendous amount of loss in that quarter of a million miles. Every time you double the distance, you get one quarter of the amount of signal in one bay path. And this is a two-way path, round trip. You could say the moon is a little bit like an aircraft echo to a radar system. You could talk about the radar cross-section of the moon if you like, but the ratio of power that you transmit and the ratio of the power that you get back are billions and billions and billions of ratio to each other. One with 26 zeros is the ratio, and you put that big number in the denominator of what you get back versus what you transmit. Is that a little bit more clear, Rich? KJ4ILK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger, KJ Fly FK. Yeah, that's more clear. Okay. Well, yeah, I'll let you get back to it there. I will try and make it back out here again to this net. KJ Fly FK, back to net control.
Now, what I was starting to say before with reference to group delay distortion, which is the main subject, group delay and group delay distortion that Wes has brought up with the most recent websites he recommends we go to study this fairly important phenomenon. Good common sense would say, I want to know the amount of delay line through my system, whether it be coax cable, antenna, filter, duplexer, whatever. They all have a different amount of delay. They have a different amount of delay for each broadband frequency going through. Good common sense would lead you to believe you put pulses through, and you can easily, you know, time the leading edge of a pulse, and therefore the leading edge of the pulse that comes back out is going to give you time delay. Good sounding theory on paper, very naive, because that pulse train really has a sine x over x of frequencies. If you generated 1 microsecond pulses on my little radar, for instance, I've got a radar where I'm transmitting 1,000 pulses per second. Each pulse is 1 microsecond long, and the center radio frequency of my radar is 1 gigahertz. You look at that composite waveform on a crystal detector and a oscilloscope, you'll see some nice round, you'll see some nice rectangular pulses, 1,000 of them per second, and 1 microsecond long for each pulse. On a time domain crystal detector oscilloscope setup, you'll say, gee, that's nice and simple. Now you take that signal at 1 gigahertz, don't detect it with a crystal detector, you put it into a spectrum analyzer, and what are you going to see? Something a hell of a lot more complicated. You're going to see the main blob of signal at 1 gigahertz. That's the center of the RF frequency you're transmitting. You're going to see a whole bunch of side lobes, in other words, frequencies of various amplitudes above and below 1 gigahertz. The first null in that plot, in that waveform, will be 1 megacycle higher, 1 megahertz higher, and 1 megahertz lower. And then 2 megahertz higher and 2 megahertz lower, you're going to see side lobes and so on, alternate side lobes and nulls. In other words, there's a whole lot of individual frequency components. Thousands of individual frequency components are inside of that RF pulsed waveform. And now, because the higher frequency components, in other words, the upper side lobes, through things like a piece of waveguide, go through faster than the lower frequency side lobes of that composite waveform, what you get back out is no longer a nice, clean, rectangular pulse. It'll have overshoot and undershoot, if it was a broadband signal like a television signal, you would be getting color distortion and echoes and all kinds of things going on in the picture. And so to measure that, you don't use a pulsed transmitter to measure it. You use a sweeping sine wave signal generator. So you know that if you put in a sine wave at 1 gigahertz and you measure how many nanoseconds or microseconds of delay takes place through your filter, your cable, your antenna, whatever you happen to be measuring, and then if you go to a slightly higher frequency or a slightly lower frequency and you re-measure the time delay, you're going to get a different number. And the way you measure the time delay is to look at the phase shift of the sine wave of RF carrier that you're putting through the system. I put through at first a 1 gigahertz RF sine wave, and I...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I put through a 1 gigahertz RF carrier, and I had some kind of a phase measuring receiver, and I set that at what I call zero phase. Now, as I go to a slightly higher frequency, the slightly higher frequency really has slightly smaller wavelengths. Therefore, the same length of cable in inches or feet is going to be a greater number of degrees of phase shift of the carrier, even if the system was perfect. The higher frequency will have more phase shift. So you measure that as dphi df, the change in phase of what goes through the system versus frequency. So a purely linear, perfect system a perfect piece of air-filled coaxial cable, for instance, when you plot phase shift versus frequency as a graph, you'll have a straight line with a 45-degree slope to it if you set up the horizontal axis and the vertical axis with the right increments to it. You'll have a 45-degree slanting line with a thoroughly linear piece of air-filled coaxial cable. That is a system that has DFDF, but no group delay distortion, because it is a pure straight line at a 45-degree angle when I set up the graph correctly. Let me drop. But now I go through a real filter, a real piece of waveguide, a real piece of coaxial cable with polyethylene dielectric, and maybe the polyethylene dielectric has a slightly different dielectric constant for the higher frequency versus the lower frequency. When I now plot that graph of DFDF, in other words, frequency shift is the horizontal axis, phase shift is the vertical axis, and I expect to get a nice straight 45-degree line. I'll suddenly realize that when I start using real components, the straight line develops a curve. That curve is called group delay distortion. The presence of the curve on that plot of phase versus frequency is demonstrating in an indirect way that's not easy to explain at first, not easy to understand at first. It's telling you something about the change in time delay versus frequency of your particular system. And so traveling wave tubes have it. Coaxial cables have a little of it. Waveguide has a lot of it. Filters have a huge amount of it. Trying to think of some of the other components. In the case of a Chebyshev filter, when you plot the time delay versus frequency, call it group delay versus frequency, you end up what looks like a mu-shaped curve. In other words, right at the 3 dB roll-off frequencies of your rectangular frequency bandpass filter, at the low frequency roll-off and the high frequency roll-off, the group delay versus frequency looks like rabbit ears. In other words, there's two peaks in the group delay. In other words, right at the frequency of roll-off of the filter, for a bunch of complicated reasons, the time delay of the filter is greatest at the places where it has 3 dB roll-off on the high side and 3 dB roll-off on the low side, and it has less time delay in the center of the filter. You would never expect that, but that's the real world of a nice, sharply tuned Chebyshev filter. Look what you got us into tonight, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, thank you very much, N2XJN. I was interested with the all of these comments that you have made about different group velocity versus frequencies. One of the interesting facts that I would like you to mention is the behavior for the high frequency when you have a nanosecond pulse through the waveguide near the lower cutoff frequency. All of the troubles that are associated with it. Now, a few other things that I'm interested with is TEM media and having to be non-disturbed dispersive. About the behavior about all of this media and eventually qualification of that media, what this term means and how it works, TEM. Another thing that I have, let me drop, is the TEM transmission lines, which happen to be understood as a disruption, dispersion-free, when you look at the Smith chart, and then you have that approximation that when we use the high frequency that we have a Z0 and the propagation constant, then I have a kind of trouble to understand at low frequency, that approximation R is similar to JVL, or we do the comparison. I mean, what is going on over there? Because I understand that we need to leave that term in the equation. The zero is relevant to the complex number. That's what I understand from that. Enter shift.
In the case of waveguide, which does have a significant amount of what's called dispersion, that really means a different amount of time delay versus the frequency going through it. It's also called group delay distortion. It's another way of calling it. If I put a really pure radar, RF radar pulse, through a very long piece of waveguide, because the high frequency components are involved in the rise time and the fall time, and the low frequency components of the radar are primarily a function of the middle of the pulse. Because the high frequency components get there sooner, the pulse, the RF pulse that comes out of a long piece of waveguide tends to have what looks like overshoot on the leading edge and the trailing edge. It's a kind of distortion created by the time shift of the individual components. Your pulsed waveform has a Fourier series to it. In other words, it's got a mathematical, predictable amount of energy at each frequency in that so-called sine X over X waveform that you will see on a properly calibrated spectrum analyzer looking at that pulsed waveform. And so, because the time domain, when you use a crystal detector into an oscilloscope and you're looking at the pulse after your waveguide, it's not a clean-looking RF radar pulse anymore. So pre-distortion techniques are used. That's one technique. Make sure you're not using very much waveguide, or make sure the waveguide is nowhere near the cutoff frequency. One of the graphs that's on one of the websites that you recommended that we go to showed that the dispersion of the waveguide, the group delay distortion of the waveguide, gets worse in an exponential manner as you go down in frequency and start approaching the lower cutoff frequency of the waveguide. Every piece of waveguide is a high-pass filter. It's got a very critical, very sharp lower cutoff frequency. And when you're below that frequency, they call it waveguide beyond cutoff. You could say that the bounce angle has gone to 90 degrees. In other words, the signal is bouncing between the left wall and the right wall, and the signal is no longer advancing. It just sits there and bounces and goes nowhere and gets hot and doesn't do anything. That's what happens when you're below the frequency where the waveguide is a half wavelength wide rectangular guide. And there's a similar phenomenon for round waveguide. So as you approach that frequency in an exponential manner, you start getting this extra distortion, extra time delay. Therefore, they call it the parabolic error, I think is one of the things they call it. So if you're smart enough to use your waveguide at much, much higher frequencies, as you start using it to the point where the waveguide is almost operating at a full wavelength instead of a half wavelength of width, and maybe even beyond that, as you go to the higher frequencies and you make sure that your waveguide might even be overmoded, as they say. In other words, the waveguide is so big compared to the wavelength you're using that it's capable of transmitting the signal in more than one mode down the guide, more than one bounce angle. And you've used suppressing devices in the waveguide so that only the dominant mode can propagate and all other modes are killed by your mode killers, your septums and other things you put in there to make sure that the undesired mode doesn't happen. If you're able to use your waveguide at much higher frequencies like that, you pick up a double benefit. Let me drop. The double benefit is that the waveguide gets much, much lower in insertion loss in dB per 100 feet. That's good. The amount of group delay distortion starts going down real fast. That's good. The only thing that's bad is you got to make sure that as you start using the guide at much higher frequencies where it's capable of more than one mode, that you're smart enough not to excite those higher modes by having an error in your transmitting and receiving system within the waveguide. You're your waveguide to coax adapter that launches the signal into the waveguide. I'm calling that the transmitting system and the receiving system, the launcher and the receiver function inside of the waveguide. As long as it's sufficiently pure and you're using a high enough frequency, these problems can almost disappear as long as the waveguide isn't many wavelengths long. Now, if you're trying to transmit your signal through 1,000 feet of waveguide, you're in a lot of trouble no matter what you do. So, as I've said many times, waveguide is great stuff. Don't use a whole lot of it. Now, there was a second subject you were bringing up, Wes, which I had trouble understanding what the question was. I'm going to send it back to you for a repeat on the question. And if I don't get it the second time, maybe John gets it and he'll explain it to me. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN, actually we have very little time left. It's 11:35, so I would like to leave that subject right now and go to a few others. I just want to briefly go to, right now I'm experiencing so little time on TechNet for the subjects I'm bringing to the attention. Let me just... one thing just for curiosity they brought, and it's at Bernie's family.com, whatever. Part number one, subject number two, which is the collection of navigation system and communication system for very low frequency communication, which is 10 kilohertz for military and commercial application. Basically, I'm not gonna talk about it a lot, but it is a very interesting article that gives information about all existing available communication system for the aviation navigation, and some of them use 10 to 14 kilohertz frequency band, which happened to be especially interesting because it is considered to be a standard of navigation system for the future. Although it says over there it is accurate to one NME, which is a nautical mile, but is a kind of very much reliable system, but and it's based on Earth reference navigation, so it's completely independent from the GPS. Ladies and gentlemen. Now, in part number one, the second subject that I brought to your attention is conversion to the vacuum energy of electromagnetic zero-point oscillation. This is a scientific paper in Class of Mechanical Energy by Klaus Wilhelm Turtur. Basically, it is a motor that uses electrostatic, as I'm sitting in electrostatic practically all the time, and the principal design of the electrostatic rotor for the conversion of the vacuum energy into the mechanical energy. He states at the end of the article that this is a potential for a sort of free energy device. As we know, free energy is the energy that is just a energy conversion from another form of energy. I wonder if you had the time to read that article.
I saw portions of it, and I didn't get a chance to study it enough to understand it. I think he's got a vacuum on one side. I think he's got a hole, and air is running through the vacuum, looking at these four vanes and creating mechanical rotation. I think he's combining it with some kind of electrostatic field, and the combination of vacuum, mechanical energy, rotation, and electrostatic field, I think he did say that he believes it's capable of creating some free energy. I wonder if anyone's ever built a working model. Do they really get continuous free energy out of it? And, I think not free energy. I think he calls it over unity. Did the machine produce more than unity to your knowledge, Wes? N2XJM, K2RIW?
N2XJM, at this time, after 2 years sitting in the subject, I can say that anything that is over unity is only from the philosophical point of view partially true. Most of these devices that I have seen, also one device that I have manufactured by myself with the group of the people, and I was there was a Lithuania experiment, is just conversion of the existing energy. So nothing is for free. There is no free lunch. Although you may say over unity, yes, it is true to the point of just one way of looking at it. But the principle of the design with the electrostatic rotor was the conversion of the vacuum energy into the mechanical energy. He gave the specified dimension and the represented values, all mathematics that was developed for it. And it was found that the hole in the center of the disk, because he made a sort of the rotor with very much exotic blades, reduced the torque, and basically what I think, since you didn't go deep into that, it would be good if people get familiar with it. The thing is that all of the basis for that paper, which is a pretty much scientific paper, is that the name vacuum is given to the space out of which nothing can be taken with the known methods, but it is well known that the vacuum is not empty, but it contains physical objects. What John actually was reading part of it, and he agreed to that. So this also reflected in this theory of general relativity by the cosmological constant, and it goes back to a gravitative action of mere space. That's by Goem. And there's a lot of knowledge or scientific background that is standing behind that. So already the mass energy equivalent is known, that the physical object within the vacuum corresponds within the certain amount of energy. And that leads to the question whether the vacuum energy can be made manifest in the laboratory environment. And he states over there that the question was answered positively, and the work was proven. He also presented a number of videos standing about that factor, so just mentioning that. Back to you, and then I'm going to the next subject.
On page 58 of that report, on chapter 4-4, it has, quote, over-unity, unquote, criteria for the exclusion of artifacts. If I read that section, is he implying that with proper definition, he thinks he has over-unity on that mechanism, Wes? Go ahead.
Well, he does have over-unity that mechanism to a certain point of understanding it, but he is not crazy about trying to keep that term or prove that term as the pure understanding of over-unity. He shows the basis of and the benefits that could be achieved from the vacuum energy of universe from the moment of the vacuum energy conversion that is delivering more energy than the operation consumes. If the condition is fulfilled, the vacuum rotors can be essential benefit for the power industry. That's what he says. Now, we know that we have, in that vacuum, we have cosmic rays, we have electromagnetic waves, we have a gravitational pulse, and then we have a magnetic fields they are passing by, and they have no problem with that. So basically, we might say that we might, as of yet, at this particular point, understand all of the mechanisms that are attached to that, but I would like John also to give his feedback on that.
Okay, John. KC2WGB, K2RW.
KC2WGB. Dick, I read the article. I don't have enough understanding of what the hell he was trying to accomplish, how we're going to generate the vacuum or what it's supposed to do. So I really can't comment on it. I'm totally ignorant. So I'll leave it up to Wesley to explain the rest. And I'll forego my X-ray question for next week so that he can have all his time.
Well, basically, he built a device that is moving by itself on a certain environment. There is a laboratory environment of a kind of replicating the space. Based on the videos that are posted, this rotor is in movement. So, basically that. From the point when I started 2 years ago, and there was a very big excitement, to the point that I'm right now in here, there is a very strong base of me standing on the rules of thermodynamics with respect to overunity as a factor of energy conversion. So for me it works this way, that we have a pipe with the water and we have a valve. So we don't care who pays for the water flowing in the pipe. It's a huge pipe and a lot of water in it. We just use a little energy to release the valve. And we have that in nature. Nobody seems to have a problem with that, which is the sun. And we don't have a problem with the heat that comes from the sun. We like it, especially during the summertime. Also, we have a water like a Niagara Falls, and that's the energy. We don't care what energy comes from. All we care is to be able to couple into it. Andrew, actually.
Why don't you briefly state your X-ray question, John?
Dick, I'm in the middle of trying to build an X-ray tube, and it's for a specific test. I have a tungsten element. It's a flat disc. It's elliptical in shape. That's going to be my anode. That's going to be installed in this glass tube, which is about 2 inches in diameter. Then I'm going to have a cathode and, of course, a heater. And that would give me an X-ray tube. What I want to do is I want to put a grid in there so that I can build an X-ray stroboscope. You got the idea?
Yes, I do. And I'm wondering why you're trying to do it with a grid inside of the vacuum as opposed to pulsing the voltage that goes through the X-ray tube. Back to you, John.
I think I can get better control, plus I don't have to have a control on my high voltage, which will be difficult for me. I'll be at about 40 kV.
Yeah, that's so your X-rays are hard enough to give you the penetration you're looking for. Okay. I think you can put a control grid around your cathode assembly, and by putting negative and positive voltages on it, you can control the stream that goes from that cathode to the anode. It strikes the anode with high voltage, 40 kilovolts at a 45 degree angle, and bouncing off of there comes your X-rays. And maybe that anode is going to be a rotating anode, so you don't burn a hole in one particular spot in it, so that it spreads out the heat. And some of the X-ray tubes, you could also have the X-ray tube running continuously and build a toothed interrupter on the outside out of tungsten or something else that's very heavy that's able of stopping the X-rays. For you to build your own X-ray tube, I wonder how much vacuum tube construction you've done. I'm a little bit afraid that that's an art and science that could set you back an awful long period of time just learning the details of getting a high enough vacuum and the Gettering function and whatever. Probably there isn't an X-ray tube with a control grid built into it, but there are various ways you can interrupt. And controlling the high voltage, that might not be so hard. I mean, how fast must the rise time of your X-rays be, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
have also another question that you can find the time of the low voltage ion chamber.
And it's going to have objects on it that I want to strobe and x-ray at the same time in different attitudes at angle, different angles. And using the rotating disc, I could make an aperture that has a lead coating on it and probably spin that up. But I think that would be a little more work. And I have done some glass fusion and you know, a lot of chemistry tubes and stuff. So doing the glass work is no problem for me. But yes, doing the Geta and that kind of stuff and getting the vacuum down hard enough, I don't have a pump for it, but I know somebody who does. But I had a little experience with it, so I think I can do it.
Detecting your stroboscopic x-rays is not going to be as easy as you think. In the past, when you used photographic film and phosphors and things like that to collect x-rays, you had to collect x-rays for a long period of time in order to fill in the empty spaces of the picture. Nowadays, with charge-coupled devices, they're a hell of a lot more sensitive and not so bad, but still, to have moving objects stroboscopically fed with x-rays, to have enough signal on each individual pulse of the stroboscopic function, give you enough exposure with your detecting device, right there might be a stronger problem than what you think is the problem. You think the problem is putting the control grid in there and really controlling the x-rays. I'm a little worried, John, that the detecting integrity, enough integrated x-ray signal to integrate up enough of the picture on the detector is a problem. Even though nowadays your dentist is using a charge-coupled device sensor that he puts in your mouth, he's still making a exposure of your teeth of a couple of seconds in order to get that picture. If he was doing that stroboscopically with pulses that are only a millisecond each, I see a real problem if your mouth was moving at the same time. You see where I'm going here, John? Over to you.
Guys, I'm sorry interrupting you.
75 milliseconds.
What was that again, Eric?
The typical CCD device that they stick in your mouth takes between 50 and 75 milliseconds worth of exposure, and at a very low level. I know I've dealt with that. And probably the easiest thing for John to do is build his tube and put a shutter in front of it.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay. We've started your problem a little bit there, John. We've given you a couple of questions to ask yourself. Wes, what would you like to discuss next? Memo number three?
Yeah, the problem that I have, Dick, is I'm really spending a lot of hours on the material. I was asked to prepare the material, posted, okay, I'm doing that. And, you know, just, we don't have the time to discuss anything. The last week I had 7 minutes for me to talk. It's just we're touching the subject. Well, I have a few things which was a low voltage 50 50 volts, the ion chamber, which is interesting, and then I have a material for the technet that I have sent to you recently, that was yesterday. Which was the material about the horizontal and vertical fields. I have a string theory to touch, and we don't have the time. The horizontally and vertically polarized components of the lightning electric fields is actually on the subject that we discussed yesterday. I was trying to explain it, but because of me having a lack of short explanation, as my English is not so good, I don't know, it was completely omitted,
When it comes to the pure number of minutes that Glenn, John, Dick, Eric, and whatever read some of the material you've presented, like these 48-minute-long YouTubes and whatever, the total amount of time that we devote to N2XJN is more than any other human being. On top of that, the rather esoteric nature of your material, Wes, is that it appeals to a much smaller audience. I get a lot of flack from people who say, why do we spend so much time on material that is useful to such a small number of people on the TechNet?
The message. I understand that. I have no problem with that. You don't have to explain this further. What I'm saying is, I do appreciate your time and involvement in this. I just thought that some subject could catch, like the lightning. You were talking a few hours about the lightning yesterday. I have something that you didn't discuss, and that's the last email. And you know, if you want to go to that for the few minutes that is left.
Okay, I'm on email number 3 now, part 3, which has subject 1, simple ion chamber, and subject 2, adjustable capacitor with dielectric. Do you want to go to that one, or you want to go to another one? It's your choice.
No, I want to go to part number 4, the horizontally and vertically polarized components of lightning electric field.
Okay, I'm on memo number 4, and it's got 2 website addresses.
The lower one, it takes you to the site. It's 2019 International Lightning Detection Conference.
Yeah, horizontally and vertically polarized components of lightning electric fields. And this is the one that talks about various amounts of ground conductivity and what effect that has.
Basically what I wanted to put to your attention, I mean, if we can talk about it next week, is that the spectral components of the electric strike, which you said many times, it's just all of the available frequency, but then we talk about the amplitude of it. And then this one says about 5 kilohertz, which is a kind of frequency dominant, but then if you go lower to ELF, then you see that you have 7.8 hertz, which is the Schumann frequency that is dominant with it, and all of this phenomena that's happening, which I was trying to explain to you, and it was kind of not understood last week, that you were mentioning the time of the right time, the leading edge of the signal from the lightning, but you were not concentrating on actually that AC rising from zero to whatever, and that already is dissipating. So when we're talking about the building, the building of the impulse, before the impulse would be able to build, is already dissipating. And that's why I brought to your attention that low voltage ion chamber, to show you that ionization happened at 50 volts and is already a detectable electrometer. I was trying to build something on it, you know, it just but I understand. I appreciate every the effort that you make for it. Appreciate.
Yeah, I was using as a reference the first few chapters of the Polyphaser book. They're the company who makes lightning arrestors, and they give you a lot of lightning information of voltage versus time and current versus time, and they are giving primarily time domain information.
They're not giving that what you have in that article. Nobody has an idea about vertical and horizontal field about the frequency spectral components that were actually here very much presented, and the comparison and the Schumann frequency role in it.
So as I was starting to say, the Polyphaser book gives you time domain information of voltage and current. This article tells us frequency domain information. And the article on frequency domain, if I was now worrying about how much interference my radio receiver gets as it's tuned to various frequencies, I see how that would be important. How else do you recommend that we use
frequency domain information, horizontally and vertically polarized, why would that be more in consideration for a guy worrying about arcing over the front end of his receiver? That's what we were sort of discussing with the lightning discussion of the other.